Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty.
It's great to be here.
Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in Christopher James, a musician, singer, songwriter, artist in his own right. Happy to have you here, sir. I know it's been a minute, like a lot of people that have been trying to get you in, and now you've landed. We're grateful to have you here, man.
I'm stoked to be here. I'm excited just to dialogue.
Yeah, I've listened to a bunch of your music, and I was actually quite surprised. And I don't want to mean this in a
bad way. I thought it was going to suck,
no,
man.
No, I go in, little tiny background that I don't mention much about me is in my former life, I was an audio engineer and a record producer.
Love
so
that.
I go into everything like super duper open-minded, like zero expectations.
Love that.
So I didn't know if I was going to get country or what.
Sure.
And I was really impressed with the production of it and the arrangement of it, and I thoroughly enjoyed your vocals. So I definitely want to get to that last single that you put out
and
talk about that. But as ceremoniously we do, and certainly with our music guests, as we press rewind. So I wanted you to press rewind for me. Take me back to where music starts to be what creeps into your life in a significantly meaningful way.
All right. This is a broad question, but it's also, it's so different for so many people. And I think for me, it started... All right, I'm going to totally call myself out age-wise. I had a cassette Walkman that I had. I think it was like my mom's, and she let me borrow it. And we were going through DeSoto Square Mall at the time in Bradenton. And I just had enough money from like doing chores that I could buy a cassette. And I had never purchased music before. And going through the sets, and we were listening to the radio on the way over, and there was one song that was just like, this is my favorite song. I love the song so much. And I looked for it. I looked for the cassette. Took me a hot minute because I have no idea how to look through music at all. I think I was like 6, 7,
you know, this something is just like straight that. Where's Waldo?
Dude, 100%. And I finally see it. It's Boys to Men, Coolie High Harmony.
Nice.
And I snag that thing up and I listen to that front to back for months. Like, just that's all I did was wear this Walkman. And that's when music was like, oh, music is not just something that is untangible. It's not just something that is on the radio that you can't control. Music is something that I could put my hands on. And I can control the music that I want to listen to. And so it was Boys to Men, Coolie High Harmony. And then after that, I think it was like going to like the other side of the spectrum. It was Garth Brooks, The Hits.
Nice.
Like, and those, I would literally just flip flop on those things. So music was like really big in that sense is where I could like actually listen to it, be in my own world, you know, sit down at my dining room table with 100 sheets of blank white paper and just try to create a world where like this music was the anthem of it, right? But then further on down the line, as you get a little older, your music changes a little bit. And by this time I was mowing lawns and riding my bike up to, there was a music shop on the corner of 43rd and Cortez in Bradenton. Sorry, I'm like seeing it in my head.
Yeah, right now. Yeah, of course. No.
And I think it was like Specs or something like that. Maybe, I don't know. But I would ride my bike up there and spend my, lawn mowing money on like, oh, damn, dude. No. It was a Bone Thugs and Harmony. Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. And then it was, oh, man.
So you got a cacophony going.
Dude, it was just, it was literally like what every 90s kid would want. I was just diving into, you know, it was Alice in Chains and it was Soundgarden. It was Metallica's Reload or Load album and all this other stuff. But I didn't start doing music. Oh, man, that's a story in and of itself.
Well, so let me
go ahead.
One of the things that I hear weaving through a lot of these artists you just named is incredible vocals, whether or not it's Soundgarden, Garth Brooks or Boyz II Men.
Sure enough.
So was that one of the things that really got you initially? Was the vocals something that grabbed you out of the gate?
I love that. And maybe subconsciously, I want to say yes. For Boyz II Men, it was Motown Philly back again.
Yeah, that's almost
it was just,
huge.
You know, just this dance fun. For Garth Brooks, it was the stories.
Mm.
Like, looking back. It was just this beautiful, like, sultry. Yeah, I'm crying.
Painting the picture.
Absolutely. I'm 7 years old crying about this guy, you know, losing his love, you know. And then, So I think subconsciously, I mean, it never hurts to have good vocals, right? When you tell a damn good story and you have vocals to match, I'm hooked.
Right.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Right.
But then, you know, you've got other people who don't have, but then you've got Chris Cornell and how, like, the man, the myth, the legend. But yeah, that was more like, I was a little bit older, a little more angsty, a lot more angsty, let's be
of
real.
Of course.
But yeah, there was definitely a through line, probably subconsciously.
So as this music is starting to make this impact on you where you can sit with your headphones on and create your universe and this starts to expound and it starts to have a place in your life, when does it start to get to you that it's like, hey, maybe I want to do this?
I love that question. So it didn't hit me in like a, oh, I want to do music. I kind of fumbled my way into it. And let's see, I was in high school. I think I was a freshman in high school. Kids around my where I was growing up in my neighborhood, we would ride the bus, and literally every day, these group of kids in my neighborhood would talk about the band that they were in. And I think it was Rage Against the Machine I'm listening to, right, in my headphones. And I'm just beating on the back of the seat. No care, no mind.
Just feeling it.
And so they came to me, like driving on the bus home from school. And they were like, do you want to be in our band? It's like, do you want to play drums? It's like, absolutely. Of course I do. Never played drums in my whole life. Never owned an instrument in my whole life besides like a $5 penny whistle thing that I got at the fair.
Yeah.
I just said, yeah, absolutely, of course. Yeah, bro.
I'm
just,
like, and what's going through your head at this point?
Just get out of the situation.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just get out of it.
Okay.
But I also didn't think much of it. You know, these are kids that I see every day. And to me, they didn't feel like, oh, man. What's funny is, like, they're some of my best friends still to this day.
Awesome.
And I didn't think they were that cool. I was like, these guys are kind of lame.
Yeah.
But at the same, like, I was also not cool and kind of lame. I was just a different kind of lame. And so I get home and I just, again, didn't think anything of it. Went about my day. About a week later, the lead singer guy came to me. He's like, hey, we're going to have practice. Should we come over to your house and have practice since you have the drum set? And I'm like, oh man, my parents get home late. You know, I need to make sure that it's good for them. I have no idea. Maybe next week, possibly. Yeah, okay, no worries. It's all good. And so I just kept brushing them off. And then I think we had like one practice at the guitar player's house where like there was bongos. Again, never touched bongos in my whole damn life. And so still no drum kit.
Yeah.
And so I go over to their house and I'm like, just being an absolute idiot on these bongos. And it was fun. Like I got to hear the song that they were working on, you know, and it was really just one song. So it was a band that had one song. That was it. And again, when I left, it was like, this is nothing. Like, this isn't going to be a thing, obviously. Like, I don't have to worry about it. And so literally like 2 days later, we're on the way to school. And lead singer guy was like, hey, dude, we're definitely going to need to practice this week because we have our first show on Friday.
And that bongo part was fire.
Dude, you need to bring that bongo energy,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, yeah, absolutely. And I was sweating it pretty much the whole day. I'm like, this is wild. Like, I thought this was going to like dissipate. I wasn't going to have to worry about it. Out of sight, out of mind. And so I get home and my stepdad gets home and I'm like, hey, I did something stupid. And he's like, what'd you do? So I told him, he goes, that was stupid. That was absolutely stupid. And I'm like, I don't know what to do right now. He's like, all right, well, get in the truck. So we get in the truck. We drive down to Sam Ash.
And shout out Sam Ash.
Dude, he paid, I think, $350 for a real crap set that came with cymbals, a cymbal pack.
Dang.
Everything. I mean, these things were made of cardboard, but you would have thought they were made of gold because of like how I have never, first of all, I have never felt love like that from a person to go, yeah, you did something really stupid, but you know what? This is an opportunity for you to like really learn something that could take your life into a different direction.
Powerful.
And so we get home. He unbeknownst to me, I thought I knew everything about my stepdad. Unbeknownst to me, he used to play drums. And so he sits down, teaches me four on the floor, and I stay up until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning learning four on the floor so that the next day the band could come over and have our first practice. Thankfully, the song was in 4/4. I had no idea. Again, bongos, no rhythm there. Right. I'm just hitting shit. I'm just going nuts.
Yeah.
And so they come over. We have our first practice. Happens to be in 4/4. We play our first show on that Friday at a church lock-in, of all places. And that was how I got into music. And I was addicted. Like, from then on out, it was still wearing my headphones, still listening to my music, but now I'm drumming along to these songs. I'm now trying to participate with these songs and feel these songs on a whole other level.
So vocals and the hooks of it all was kind of your gateway, but drums is where you started?
Yeah, dude.
Okay, yeah. So...
Little punk kid doing punk rock drums. So the vocals never really... I mean, the vocals got me into the music, and the vocals, like,
you're right,
informed me about what music I wanted to experience, but then the drums pushed me into, like, Bad Religion. Like, go listen to Bad Religion. Go listen to, you know, Less Than Jake if you
want to. Well, another good vocal
example. Yeah, dude, you're not wrong. Yeah,
there's some kind of through line there.
Subconsciously, I'm like, you've got to have a unique voice. You can't sound.
Yeah, if there's good vocals, I can
I'm all about this, dude.
Yeah.
It's so great.
Okay, so you start to practice and perform basically in lockstep.
Yeah.
At what point do you start to feel like I'm a drummer?
Oh, okay, so I never really felt like I never really felt like I was a drummer, but I loved to drum. And I think it wasn't my inability or my lack of talent. I think it was just that, you know, we have that imposter syndrome, you know, and it's the fake it until you make it kind of a deal.
Right.
I still feel like, even to this day, I don't feel like I'm a good singer. And it's just that there are so many other people who are so much better than I am. So what does my voice contribute to, you know, to the talent? But it's just that thing that artists do when imposter syndrome kicks in.
Yeah, right.
But there was like a couple of, Sam Ash, I guess, had a couple of, you know, like drum offs and drum stuff like that. So I would go over there and I did pretty well. And then at the punk shows that we would go to and play at, we would have drum offs. And so I got to feel like I was doing okay at that part of drumming.
And this was all through high school?
Yeah, all through high school.
Okay, so when does that start to feel more serious, or when do you start to feel like I'm not really a drummer, I'm just playing one on TV?
Ooh, I love that. I don't know if I ever really took that shroud off in the sense of like I'm just playing one on TV until maybe the senior year of high school. And that's when we were playing around a little bit more. We were going around Florida a little bit more. We had some friends from North Carolina and a couple of other, Georgia and a couple of other places that were like, you know, you guys should come on out. You guys are great. You know, it's a lot of fun. So I think that was affirming in the sense of like, yeah, you're doing the musician thing right now, man. And that's really, really great. You're not necessarily a fake drummer. You're not, you know, just putting one on or anything like that.
Right.
So I think that was really affirming in that sense. But even through, like, even when I went to college, I couldn't bring my drum set. And so that's another story in and of itself. Couldn't bring the drum set. And so I ended up selling it. And I learned how to play guitar from my roommate's, like, I don't know, it was a POS guitar. But I just learned how to play in an open tuning. I didn't know how to play a G chord or a D chord or anything like that. I just played like I was Dashboard Confessional, right? Just like nice. An open tuning, play with two fingers.
And, yeah.
You know, but
there's chords all over the place.
All
then.
Over. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. So that actually kind of was bringing me back to a thought I wanted to revisit. So as you're going through high school and music is becoming more of a passion and you're going to go off to college, did you have some other thing you were thinking about doing with your life?
Oh, yeah. Instead of drumming?
Instead of music.
So all throughout high school, like I was, even though I didn't feel like I was that good, I loved the community that the music community gave. And I wanted to participate in that. And I loved being in the studio. Like when we did a really kind of garage rock style, you know, put a microphone in a room kind of EP, And that was so much fun. It was so electric. And I wanted to kind of be a part of that. So in my head, I was like, you know, if this doesn't work out, I'll just be like a session drummer, you know, at some studio, someplace. Like that would be a lot of fun. But for the most part, like there was nothing that I wasn't looking forward ahead in the sense of like where music could take me in that sense. So I was still trying to like keep my feet on the ground to a certain degree. Communications was like my focus when I went to college. So, you know, just general education or communications major. So
it was just a way to keep moving forward in what seemed like a grounded way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at what point does that start to be like, I guess this isn't where my path is?
Oh, man. So that is a great question. I think, well, life happened. And
stupid life happened.
Oh, man, I'm telling you what. I've reached a point in life where I can look back at my life and go, I was such a different person. I had such a different worldview on life, you know, but it's brought me here.
Of course.
You know, and there's parts of it, like if I could redo it, would I? Absolutely. But then you have to question, it's that butterfly effect. If you redo this and do it in a different way, are you going to be a different version of yourself now? Like I like who I am right now. It's taken me a long time to get there, but I feel like right now I'm enjoying who I am as a person. Music as like a career or even as like a songwriter, in life, it was never, I want to be mindful of what I say. It wasn't, supported, if that makes sense. It was always like, oh, that's a good hobby.
Right.
Like, you know, but don't let it get in the way of, you know, getting a real job. You know, if you have a family, supporting your family, because music isn't going to do that. You know, does music make you happy? Awesome. That's great. You can put that on the back burner. Like, happiness doesn't necessarily lead to anything.
You're right.
You know, it's like this. We live in America. We live in a capitalistic society. We need to contribute.
It's so counterintuitive.
Oh, absolutely, man. Yeah, happiness and capitalism doesn't go together very well. But it didn't really. I think for most of, because I've only been doing music. My son will be 13 on Halloween, and I started right before his first birthday. And so I've only been doing it for 11, 12 years. And so prior to that, it was never something that, was looked at as like, yeah, you could do this. Like, or it, if it's anything, like just do it in church. Like that's what you could do. Just go to church, sing in church, and then have fun.
Right.
You know, go back to work.
Yeah. Well, and partly too, because that's an interesting tumultuous period in music. You know, why make music? This is a very tall order.
Well, there's a lot of ignorance too. And I say that, I don't say that judgingly. I say that because we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
And so there's a lot of there's a lot of ignorance when it comes to what the music industry looks like. Like we can, you know, you can say, well, I want to do an album. Awesome. I think you should. It would be amazing. I mean, the abilities that we have now, you can do an album in your home.
Yes.
And you can, you know, and you can fly tracks from great artists to help you do that. And you can, there's a website called BandLab where you can AI master your song right there and boom, you've got it. You've got a single right there that you did in your home. It's absolutely amazing. So the access to music is fantastic. But what is expected of music and the music industry now is completely different. And there's so much ignorance towards what it is to succeed. Man, when we were in the 90s, people were like, even early 2000s, it was like, oh, you need a label, you need to be on the road, you need a tour, and you've made it. You've got a couple million in the bank right now. But now, you know, you've got a song that does 500 million spins on Spotify and you've got a $350 check.
Right. Yeah. Well, and this begs the question, and I want to mission drift just a little bit.
No, please.
Because we kind of straddle the same timeline. what do you think about the barrier to entry being so low now? I mean, I'm going to go ahead and assume that you can see it as a gift and the curse of it all.
Yeah.
But I'm curious what your more specific feelings are on the fact, like you said, now you can be in your bedroom, fly in tracks from someone from a studio.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a whole 90s kid. Us would couldn't have even fathomed it.
No, not at all, man. We had like 4-track recorders that we would try to do stuff. And I still mess that stuff up.
All and the having
time.
To mail things. Yeah. And, you know what I mean? Like, you know.
Oh, man. I think having the bar low is beautiful. I think it's dichotomous, because having the bar low is beautiful because the on ramp to music should be low. It's a beautiful creative world that can literally save somebody's life. But looking at it like as a career choice, it's almost like a hydra. In some senses, and forgive the analogy. If the music industry is anything, it's kind of like a hydra. There's these heads that are really just kind of like controlling the narrative and controlling what succeeds and what doesn't succeed. And you cut one off and then there's two more because maybe one was successful and now you've got multiple versions of what that looks like. And we've got AI now, which is really, I try to be open-handed with that, and that's a topic in and of itself. But because the on-ramp is so, because the bar is so low and the on-ramp is so easy to get on, it becomes bottlenecked. And so the idea of having so many artists and so little space for success, or like, I think I heard a stat somewhere, and forgive me, I'm pretty sure this is wrong, but there's something like, 1 million songs or something are released a day, like just around the world by anybody and everybody. It could be anything from like 500,000 to 1 million songs a day are released, like continuously. That is just, that's going to bottleneck. And then whatever the music outlet looks like, it's just going to get constipated. And you're just going to, it's just a bizarre kind of world.
Yeah, well, it's kind of led to this other part, mission drift, even from the mission drift, where people are getting kind of siloed off. And now, you know, like you said, you used to be able to go on the road, make yourself a fan base. Yeah. You could expect to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Well, now, if you can garner 1,000 to 10,000 loyal fans and exist in a world this big, you can actually thrive to
some
degree.
You really, really could. And I've been able to see that. Like, I've got friends who are singer-songwriters that tour the United States on a constant basis and have a great living and do an amazing job at it through a living room concert circuit. And so they literally go from living room to living room to living room to living room, playing to 30 to 100 people, you know, every show that they have, and they will make a great living out of that. And that's literally just living in a bubble of living room of music enthusiasts that open up their doors so that singer-songwriters who you will not hear on the radio get to be heard, seen, you get to understand their stories. And it's just a beautiful ecosystem. But then again, I was just telling a friend of mine that I'm trying to get into a room, into a venue. And I can go to Orlando and I could sell out Judson's Live, which is a really beautiful place in Orlando. Or I can go to Jacksonville and I can play at Blue Jay Jack's, which is right on Jacksonville Beach. And we could sell that out. And it's amazing. Or we can go to Georgia and we can play in LaGrange and sell out that room. But if I come home, I have a hard time drawing people here.
Right.
And it's like, wow. It's like, even though I live here. So because you can succeed in these certain places, it doesn't necessarily mean that all places are easily accessible or that all places are going to be fruit giving to you when it comes to the success. So it's really like you really do have to be intentional on how you nurture that following. So you can do it within that living room music ecosystem, or you can do it through, you know, online marketing and all this other stuff. It just, you really have to kind of pick a lane and invest in it.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of the necessity is the mother of invention part that we're at now. That's kind of interesting to me to hear of like a bedroom tour or a living room tour type thing. What do you think necessitates that, or do you think makes that more or an advantageous thing now? I mean, I know we always used to have underground music regardless, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But now the underground exists in a totally different way.
Yeah, I get that. Being a part of like one of those underground veins of music, there was nothing like showing up to the warehouse, not really knowing who was going to be playing, but just knowing the pit's going to be awesome, the music is going to be raw, it's going to be a great night of sweating, and you're going to enjoy yourself. It's almost like I have kids, and sometimes when you go to parks or places where just there's tons of kids, you'll see these bubble machines. That's kind of what music feels like right now. Everybody has their own bubbles, and it's hard to find those. It's hard when those bubbles get together because they don't. They'll just pop, and so or getting to a bubble is difficult. You know, it's like, well, where's the goth metal bubble? Where does that go?
Yeah.
It's like, well, you've got to be at this place at this time, or you can, you know, it's not on Facebook because the genre doesn't necessarily like Facebook. So you can, you know, it's on Instagram or it's on, you know, like Blue Sky or something like that. So finding music or finding the veins of music, or maybe I need you to expound a little bit on your question.
Well, it all kind of centers around the question of why.
Okay.
Why do this? Because.
Oh, I love that.
Because it used to be where we could, and I know people in other videos have kind of touched on this, where it used to be we kind of would have these kind of centers of cultural significance. Mm. We'd have Michael Jackson until Kurt Cobain takes him off, and we'd all know who these people were.
Yeah, yeah.
Regardless if your dad listened to Nirvana, he knew who Kurt Cobain was.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now you could get to a certain size, and still people will have no idea who you are.
I feel that.
So it's kind of... What's the framework of doing this now when you can plateau and that's now some kind of level of success?
Yeah, I get you. I think it speaks back into the bottlenecking idea because there's such an influx of artists, such an influx of music. Because back then it was more the labels that guided. They would find talent and, you know, on the road, they would find talent, sign talent, release talent. And so it was more, they were cherry picking what was accessible because we didn't, now we have an online platform that.
The accessibility is the bit.
Oh, it's right there. And it doesn't matter who you are, or where you're from. If somebody finds it, somebody likes it, shares it with somebody else, it just becomes that viral entity. And then that nobody becomes a somebody overnight, and we don't know about it, but somebody else could. A whole community, you know, a whole bubble of society
right
now knows of this person and are blowing them up, you know. Chappell Roan is one of those kind of idealistic people where, I mean, her music is absolutely fantastic. And there's a video, I actually got schooled a couple of weeks ago, because there's a video of her a couple of years ago, just her and her keyboard out at like a park playing music. And she's playing, I don't think it's Pink Pony Club, but it's something similar. And she's playing this song, and then it's like 3 years later, and she's on this biggest, you know, she's on the biggest stage she's ever been in her life. And she's like, it could happen overnight. Well, she wasn't saying it could happen overnight, but the video was.
Right.
And I was like, that is amazing and wonderfully inspiring. And it is. It's wonderfully inspiring.
Agreed.
But then I got a little education. It's like, oh, well, she was signed before that. She had a marketing team that was working with her. Like, she's been in the business, and that's the other hard part of it. She had already been in the business for a good while longer than just the overnight success that we kind of saw growing last year or 2 years ago.
I was going to say once it got on the radar-ish.
Yeah, once it got on the radar, it was unstoppable. And she is still unstoppable, which is lovely. But that's the other part of kind of how music goes is because there are so many players, because there are so many players, there are just as many teams. And so you have teams of people behind these players who are just trying to develop them, trying to put them out in front of the right people at the right time, just to have a Chapel Roan moment where something catches fire, something catches the attention, and then you ride the wave. And so, you know, a lot of that's where you'll hear a lot of stories of talent that are picked up and kind of shepherded in a way, you know, like go this way, let's get you in front of these people. And then all of a sudden dropped, you know, we put $100,000 into your album, you know, it's almost done. And then they get in front of a panel and then they don't do as well as they were expecting. And then boom. All right. Well, thank you very much. We're going to cut ties with you kind of a thing. And it's heartbreaking to see because it's that music machine that is just trying to, you know, cultivate and create pop stars or create the wave. It's, you know, it's the wave machine at fucking, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then we're just trying to ride that wave.
Yeah. Where the music is where the business is the music, but the music isn't the business.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's, you know, it's such a very dichotomous, and I think it will always be that way.
Yeah. Well, we're definitely, the pendulum has swung that way very hard right now.
And it will come back. Like there are the generation that's coming up now that sees all of this and is disgusted by the capitalism of it all. They're finding ways to kind of, you know, shirk Spotify and say, no, you know, I'm not listening to Spotify, or maybe they'll do Tidal or something like that. But, you know, they've gone back to CDs. You know, we saw the vinyl inflection a couple of years ago where everybody was buying vinyl again, which is awesome.
Yeah, couldn't be happier
Dude,
about that.
So stoked on it. And then there was like a little resurgence of like bringing cassette tapes back, which I thought was like gnarly as hell. I'm like, that's the coolest thing. I love this. I had to find a tape player somewhere at a garage sale somewhere. And now cassettes are coming back, or not cassettes, I'm sorry, CDs are coming back.
Yeah.
Because it's a tangible, physical thing that they can hold. It's not going to be on a computer anymore. It's going to be intentionally listened to and intentionally loved and appreciated. And I think, you know, that generation that's coming up right now is musicians and music lovers. They're going to be they're going to be the ones that, fingers crossed, really bring music back to a place that is... It unplugs the
million songs a day feed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was going to say, so I'm like, if we're constipated, it's going to, you know, it's going to unplug it kind of a thing. Terrible analogy.
Well, you mentioned before accessibility, and I think that's a big thing for music right now because attention is the commodity. Oh. And if your songs, your art period isn't exceedingly accessible in one way or the other, you got no prayer. And I really want to get your view on what you think makes an accessible song or accessible piece of art. But here's my anecdotal story on this.
I can't wait.
When I was first trained to be a producer, they told me that you had 15 seconds. When you got to submit a track to A&R, you had 50. This was 2002, 2001, I'll date myself. They say you had 15 seconds with A&R, and if you couldn't hook your song with A&R in 15 seconds, you were done. So I got used to focusing on that first 15 seconds and everything I ever did. It just became part of my habit of creating. Recently, I've been trying to get more effective on doing things for YouTube. So I look up effective practices for YouTube thumbnails. Mm-hmm. And they said that the period of time that you have now to garner someone's attention with a thumbnail is 0.3 seconds.
100%.
0.3, I almost rolled out my chair.
No, man.
I was like, the best I got is two words. 0.3 seconds. So we all know we're 15 seconds is a pipe dream. If you got 15 seconds, that's an hour and a half now.
Oh, man.
So
you
are clearly strike me as someone who writes their songs carefully, intentionally. Mm. Your compositions are crafted really well
from
my subjective standpoint.
That's okay. I appreciate that.
So I'm curious what you do along the way to maintain accessibility in these arrangements.
I love that. First of all, thank you. That means a lot. That's beautiful affirmation. Also, it is still wild to me because I have a question for you as well after this. The 15 seconds, I think it's now like even just within producing a song, if you can't capture their attention in like 5 seconds, 3 seconds with a song, it's mind blowing to me. But when it comes to writing a song, I've been asked the question, like, what comes first, lyrics or the music, kind of a thing. And it really, it depends on what kind of mood I'm in at the time. It depends on what kind of access I have on me. Like, do I have a guitar on me? Do I have a keyboard on me?
Singing to my voicemail.
Oh, dude, I have thousands of voice notes.
Awesome.
Of just like random. I was listening to some outside, just like, is this something that I want to work on? And I do subscribe to the idea of like, you have to get their attention like right out of the gate. Some of my favorite songs, even as a kid, in some fashion, like I was talking about this the other week because there was a song that I released a couple of years ago called I Can Only Love You in a Song. And I wanted to put this French recording on the front end of it because it's peculiar. It'll just catch you a little bit off guard and it'll get your attention, but it'll set up the rest of the idea of the story.
Mm.
And so I thought this would be a good earworm, first of all, to just kind of like bring them into the song and then have the strings come along and do that. But that didn't really go, but it was definitely an idea and maybe something we'll revisit once we work on like this second album. But it is a part of like my musical intentionality to, in some way, shape or form, make you feel something within the first couple of seconds of a song. And if I can do that, either it's like there's a song called Love You Better, which on the record, it's just like a three-part harmony thing and it sounds really, really fun. But then live, it's a little bit more abrasive. It's these very staccato hits and more of an attention grabber. That's pretty much
so,
where it's at.
So how do you navigate the end user, as it were, when you're writing songs? Or do you at all?
ADHD over here. So I've had every kind of conversation in my mind already that the end user in some way, shape, or form could appreciate or tear my song apart. Like, I can be objective to a song or very subjective to a song. Like, there are a couple of songs that I've released and I listen to them. I'm like, I don't know how I feel about them still. But then I play them live. I'm like, no, I really do love this song. You kind of have to hold it open-handed and understand that music is whatever the listener wants it to be. And so if they want it to be something that's going to heal them in a moment, then it could be that. If they want to be angry at it because they had a bad day and it's not their thing, then they can be pissy about it and comment on a YouTube channel, you know, like, this is crap, you know.
This made my bad day worse.
Absolutely. It's like, learn how to sing, yeah. Long-haired boy, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, send.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think about it, but then I don't in the same breath because when it really comes down to it, and I think you were kind of hinting to this, is the why.
Right.
I just want, when I started doing music, I just wanted to make my kid proud. Like, I wanted to make myself proud and I wanted to make my kid proud and show him that he can follow his dreams too. If I could show him how to do it, he can do it too. And so that's the through line through everything.
Yeah. And that's what I was just going to try to circle back to. Yeah. So take me back to when your son's turning a year and you're changing gears.
So it was right before his first birthday. And it was one of those things where fatherhood is, you know, the duality of fatherhood is hard to juggle, and not being a father before, I didn't necessarily know how to. I knew how to ruminate about it. I didn't know how to like put my ruminations into a place that was healthy, you know. And so I would just emotionally word vomit, not in a bad way, but just like, you know, oh my gosh, being a dad is so hard. I don't want to fail him.
Right.
You know, I want to be a good dad. I want to be a present dad. And, you know, my mortality coming into play. It's like all of these emotions coming into one. And so I went through like a bottle of Malbec one evening and I have all of these thoughts and I decided just to put them into a song. Like, maybe that would help a little bit. I was doing music for a church at the time and I was listening to this cat out of Texas named David Ramirez, and his music was kind of being a bit of a salve to myself, and so I kind of used a similar chord progression that he was using, and just put pen to paper, strummed sitting, you know, crisscross applesauce downstairs, and just penned out this song, a song called "My Heart Wasn't Ready," and it came out really easy, and it felt really cathartic. Like,
that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, it was life giving in the moment, and I felt like, you know, these hard emotions that I'm wrestling with right now, I'm going to continue having as a father, as a person, as a human. And I still have so many more of them. And so that weekend I wrote like 5 songs that happened to be those. Well, I wrote more than 5 songs, but I took 4 of the ones that I really liked and I put them on my first EP that I recorded with one microphone.
And what was the impetus for more songs? Was it that, was it the addiction to the catharsis, as it were? Or it was a matter of you just let the floodgates open and it was just like, there it all was.
I want to say it was a little bit of both. If anything, it was the permission to do it.
Ah.
It was allowing myself to say, it was allowing myself not to hear the voices in my head that were telling me it's just a hobby. You know, it's a waste of time.
Ah.
You know, you don't have to do it. You know, you have to focus on, you know, be a good dad, be a good worker. I could take all of those voices and just kind of mute them for a second and really focus on what was helping me in the moment. And I just wrote. And that was the permission I gave myself to say, go and get him, Tiger. Slap him.
Well, I couldn't be more grateful for you saying that, because that's one of the operative words we use around here and one of the backbones of the podcast. We like to share these stories and hear these stories because I do feel that what people get stuck at is not giving themselves permission. So if you could just expound on what it feels like as you're walking into these new shoes of I've given myself permission to do this and it doesn't make me a bad person.
Sure.
Or
sure.
I'm not neglecting my spostas.
Yeah, isn't that wild? So, I mean, I think we take a lot of what we hear, and of course, I don't want to throw a broad blanket on it, but, you know, we're all individuals, but we're also we're more alike than I think we would like to admit. And if somebody says something, it's going to affect us in some fashion. Growing up, I was very susceptible to people's words. Like I took them. I thought they were gospel, you know? And so having those words just kind of pile up and putting on a facade and saying, you know, it's okay. I don't need it. I don't need to do music. It's fine. Like, I'm enjoying what I'm doing now, even though none of it is really making me happy. The idea of allowing yourself permission, first of all, the idea of giving yourself permission in the first place.
It's scary.
It's very scary because you've kind of taught yourself, you've psyched yourself into a position of saying you don't deserve to put yourself into this position. What you deserve is what you're experiencing now. And giving yourself permission to give yourself joy, like, or to experience joy and not feel guilty about it.
Right.
Oh my gosh. And I think there's a lot to be said about what puts us into positions like that. But like, I think once you allow yourself freedom to express something or freedom to receive something, it opens up the floodgates to receive so much more. It's like, I'm going to allow myself the permission to do this and be happy about it. I know my kids are gonna, my kids benefit from my happiness. I'm a better dad because of my happiness. I love to run. And so when I haven't gone for like a 4 or 5 miler or something like that, it's been a couple of days, my kids feel it because my headspace isn't the same. You know, the serotonin through my body isn't the same. Allowing myself to experience joy and happiness makes me a better person. But
that's such a mind blower.
Yeah, it really is a wild thing. But then you can open up yourself and say, I also deserve to receive grace for myself. You know, I'm a human being. I'm a fallible person. I'm not always the best dad buttoned up. You know, like the other evening, the boys were doing something And I got upset and I felt it immediately. And I went, no, I'm so sorry, guys. Daddy had a rough day. I didn't mean to project on you. You know, that's all on me. I'm so sorry. But it's allowing yourself to go, hey, brother, like, take a moment.
Right.
You're not a bad dad. You just had a difficult moment. Give yourself grace and walk past it.
How much do you think being able to have your art be a part of your life helps you be able to maintain that mindfulness?
Oh, man. I think more so than if I hadn't had it. I think if I didn't have music as an outlet, I would be bottling things up. Not just in these are my raw emotions. Like, every song is like some raw emotion that I am getting out in some fashion. I don't necessarily prescribe to that idea, but it is something that if I have all of these emotions, and one of the best ways or more so, let me say it like this. If the thing that gives me life and allows myself to experience joy and to experience happiness, that bleeds over into all the other aspects of my life. And so if I can take that, it's going back to the run idea. If I go for a run and my body feels great and my endorphins are up and I'm smiling, you know, my serotonin is pumping through my body and I come home, I'm much more able to just be, first of all, present with my kids, present with the home, gracious to my partner, you know, just much more aware than if I were to be bogged down by my 9-to-5.
Right.
Than just to be, you know, feeling like I'm, you know, I have no time. There's more dishes in the, you know, in the dishwasher. I have to take those out. I've got to do laundry. I have no time. You know, it's just when we don't allow ourselves those moments of joy and sit with it. And that's the other part. Like, we need to, that's why meditation is a great thing. Like, just sitting with things and observing. Oh, sorry, I got a little bit away from your question.
No, no.
Observing what we have and being grateful for it.
Like, yes.
That gratefulness mentality will really put things into perspective.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. Last year, we dubbed 2024 the year of extreme gratitude. Yo. And it worked out so well, we just decided we're rolling it into this year.
Might
too.
As well.
Yeah, we're rolling it.
Yeah, man. Yeah, okay, even in the hard stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever. It's the declaration of gratitude is a powerful thing.
I love that.
Okay, so then that brings me back to where I wanted to cycle back to. So you write this first song, you give yourself permission, you write these four or five other songs, they become this first EP that you do. When does it start to dawn on you this role that you've described, where being able to do music and have your art is being able to put your gas mask on? Ooh, first, and yeah. Now you can, when does this start to set in?
Wonderful, wonderful imagery you just gave, by the way. I think it started kicking in a couple of years in, because when I started going down the road of like doing music, it was, even though I gave myself permission to write these songs, to record these songs, to occasionally perform these songs, I did not give myself permission to go to the proverbial next level. I was coasting. I got up to floor one and I'm like, this is a good floor. Let's stay on this floor. This is a good floor. I like this floor.
Flying low is safe.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And so I think once I started getting into, playing bigger rooms and the experience with the listener was a little more intimate and a little more affirming. It wasn't just, you know, like an Irish pub on Main Street. You know, where you're really just background noise.
Right.
And nobody's really experiencing, you know, the stories or anything like that. But once I started playing listening rooms and stuff like that, and opening up for bigger artists, I kind of allowed myself permission to go, you can step this up a notch. I think you could step this up a notch. And again, it is uncomfortable when you go from one step to another step. Because the weight shifts, even though our bodies are built to kind of like naturally understand, you know, our equilibrium is our whole mind is telling our body what to do. It doesn't always feel that way when we're carrying a load.
Right.
And so going from one step to another step, and I'm carrying the responsibility of being a 9-to-5 employee, of being a good father, of being a good partner, you know, of making sure the mortgage is paid, you know, all of these things.
Lifing.
But also being responsible to myself and saying, this is something that I want to experience. This is something that is giving me joy. I am nervous as all get out of taking, of going from this place to this place, because it could fail. I could trip and I could fall back down to floor one. Or if things, you know, don't go the way I'm hoping or dreaming, I could quit. I could, it could push me to quit in a moment. You know what, the big part of it, sorry, I just had this a little bit epiphany. When 2020 happened, when we all just kind of like closed ourselves in, and I'm playing to cameras and no audience, I think that's when it really dawned on me. Like, it was really a reality slap in the face of what kind of joy I have the privilege to experience when I get to share my music and share the stories, is because I can sing for Facebook Live, you know, through a camera, and I've put myself through like the best audio software that I could find. I've made, you know, these custom graphics and everything else, so it looks like, you know, it looks like I'm on CNN or something like that.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not getting any real conversation back and forth. It's really just me. I'm having a conversation with an inanimate object.
Mm.
But when you get to play live and you get to play music with somebody or for somebody, it is a dialogue. You know, I give you my story and you respond, or you don't respond. That in and of itself is a response. And so that kind of was like, if you're going to do something, you need to do it now. And so I started putting together some of the best performers that I knew, and really just kind of trying my best to become the best version of myself live.
So do you like to goat yourself into the uncomfortable, or was it a matter of time is ticking and I'm not wasting it?
So it's a mixture of both. Okay, so quick story. I think it was 2017. A lot of things happen when I've had a couple of glasses of wine, straight up.
Fair.
And it was late at night. I'm on my my laptop, and I happened to get a contact for like this really pretty well-known artist in the United States. I was like, I want to see. This is a cat that I get compared to a lot. I want to see if I can like jump on a tour with him. That would be killer. But like, I'm still playing coffee shops. You know, I'm a nobody. I'm still a nobody, but yeah. Like I'm at this point, I don't think that there's any chance. And so it just like little liquid courage gave me the right words to say at the right time and sent the email off, and I kind of forgot about it in the morning. And then somewhere around like 10, 11 o'clock the next day, I get an email back, and I still remember like I was in a meeting at the time, and I get a ding on my phone, and I look, and I'm like, oh my God, no. And so like my whole body shakes, and I'm like, oh gosh, I
don't. Distraction for the meeting, oh, out man, the window.
Yeah, I don't even know what's happening anymore. Everything, it just sounds like a Peanuts character, you know, or teacher or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I get back to my office and I'm looking at it, and sure enough, he's like, yeah, he's got 4 Florida dates, but you have to supply backline. And at the time I had no idea what backline was. I was like, dope. Count it, sign it, let's go. I was like, this could never happen in 100 million years.
Yeah.
But it was just one of those things where it's like, I kind of goaded myself into it. Like, if I don't have enough time to just dilly-dally, I got into the game late. You know, it's not necessarily a young man's game kind of a thing, but I'm realizing how big of a lie that is.
Yeah, it is.
But then you almost have to push yourself into these uncomfortable areas because, or at least I have to. It's not in my nature to, like in my natural nature to go, oh, I could totally jump off this cliff right now into the water. That's, let's go. You know, I almost have to have somebody go, I bet you can't do that. And be like, oh, watch, you know?
All right, now I gotta.
Oh, dude, it's so bad. I mean, that's kind of, yeah. Wait, if somebody tells me I can't do it, it becomes my number one thing. Like, I have to show them that I could do this.
But, love that.
Yeah.
Well, I want to kind of jump around a little bit because I want to talk about your last single that you put out.
Yeah.
What was the title of it again? Forgive me.
Just Breathe.
Yeah, Just Breathe. I really enjoyed that track. And from a production standpoint, I was really taken aback by it. Talk to me a little bit about your recording process and specifically that song.
You got it. So I'll talk about the song first really quick. And then because I love talking about the recording process. The song came actually because I have a real hard time with anxiety. And a couple of years ago, like it got real bad where I would have like a double breath and I couldn't catch my breath.
Mm.
And I would just, people were like, are you about to sneeze? I'm like, no, I'm just really embarrassed now.
Yeah, right.
It's just, I would be in a moment and it would happen usually before like I would perform or something like that. But it would be like where I could not, it's like it really is like that. And, I couldn't catch my breath. And so I just like put pen to paper and just started again, putting those raw emotions down really quick. And those words came first before the music. But then once I started feeling out what the song, I wanted a little bit of a juxtaposition. You know, this is a difficult song because it's, you know, it's a song about anxiety, but I want it to be fun. It doesn't have to be a heartbreaking song or anything like that. It can be be something we could dance to. And so that's kind of where the almost Stax Records soul sound came from. But also like I'm such a Stax kid. I love old school Motown. I love old soul. Otis Redding is like my guy.
Nice.
Like, yeah, like I adore that man.
I was going to say, I guess now that you say that, I can definitely hear that.
But the recording process. So the guy who produced it, David Brimer, amazing artist, musician out of Central Florida, Bartow area, Lakeland. And there's a studio in Bartow called Omnipop, opened up by Aaron Marsh, who had a band called Copeland back in the day. But this place is, first of all, it's in Bartow. There's not a lot in Bartow.
Right.
But I can tell you, this place is popping. Like, It's an old school, all wood floor, all wood paneling room with
very cool.
Just some of the best instruments and recording gear I've ever seen. But yeah, it was just absolutely stunning. We decided to do everything analog for the most part. I mean, still going in the box, but we wanted to make sure that everything, whatever sound we got, it was done analog.
Captured with moving air.
Absolutely. So drums, bass, organs, you know, guitars. We had like five or six guitars going through the wall of amps that they have over there, which is old school Fenders, you know, old Gibsons, just a lot of fun. And they have just,
love it.
Yeah, it was just the coolest thing. It was the coolest thing. If you're ever around, let me know and I'll come with you.
Oh, I would love
to. Yeah, we'll just check it out.
I love a studio field trip.
Yeah, dude, for sure.
So how do you handle like the arrangements of like the brass and things? Do you do all of that?
I love the question. So usually when I write a song, I hear everything. Like if it's just me on a guitar, I'm hearing the drums, I'm hearing the piano, I'm hearing all this other stuff. But I also know that music is a whole conversation. And so if you've got a whole band, I can tell you what to say, or I can just have you say it.
Right.
Like you can say it in your own words. And so I think maybe like 3 out of 5 times I'm going to literally leave it up to, if it's just me playing all the instruments, then yeah, I'm going to play exactly what I hear in my head. But you know, 3 out of 5 times I'm going to let you speak as a musician, like my bass player, Vinny, who's on, you know, most of the recordings. So he's on Just Breathe. The album, The Kindness Never Quits, the majority is me on drums, bass, all of it.
Mm.
But then I've got a lot of cats like John Hetherington's playing keys.
Oh, he's great.
Oh, he's just one of the best. Andrew Glasgow is on bass on a couple of songs too. Just real good cats.
Nice.
But it's literally one of those things. It's like, this is your instrument and you have your own language. I want you to speak your language. And so there's a song we just finished. I mean, we finished the music of it. The vocals are still being kind of done. But again, it's one of my favorite songs right now, just listening to it. But that's what we did. It was literally, I had the idea for what the drums should do. I had the idea for what the guitar should do. But for the most part, it was like, I want you to play what you hear. And as we're recording it, Vinny's coming up with these bass lines. I'm like, hell yeah, keep going with that. You know, Cameron, my keyboard player, he's coming up with these lines. I'm like, hell yeah, do more of that. I didn't hear that. That's not a word I would use.
Right.
That's not a language I would use.
Right.
And
so you get to play part producer before you get to production.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's my favorite part. Like watching a song take shape and become its own character and become its own thing, its own identity. Whew, it's like, because it could look one way and you're like, this is a good song. This is fun. And then have maybe a couple of weeks of trying to flush it out or figure different languages out or figure different timbres out and, find that this is the best version of it, where it's five different people speaking. It's almost like five different harmonies. You know, one singer sounds great, but if you put five of them and they're all complimenting one another, how big and beautiful can that sound?
I miss that.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
I miss that.
It's really, really cool.
So it is really about serving the song.
Yeah.
Ultimately, always for you.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a time in your growth as the center of this universe where you got precious about things, or was open-mindedness always the mantra?
I love that. I want to say that open-mindedness is always, it's always a thing. Again, because this is communal. Like, even when we're playing live, I want to make sure that everybody's having a good time. Everybody's playing whatever they kind of want to play. As long as they're serving the song, play what you want, kind of a thing. Because we get to do this.
And right.
This is a communal experience we're all experiencing right here. There are some things where, like... I'll become a little precious on like what the drums will do. Again, drums first instrument. And so there are a few things where I'm like, I feel like the drums should do this and this. And so I won't become precious about it, but I'll push maybe a little bit harder, or instead of like having open hands like this, I'll maybe bring them up just a little bit.
Is it partly because you hear it so clearly?
Probably more than anything, or it's just how I feel the energy is in the song itself. If a song isn't moving in some fashion, then I think the drums can be the driver.
Oh yeah.
And so if it feels like it's lacking energy or something like that, then yeah, I'll try something percussion wise. I'm like, let's bring a shaker in. Let's maybe bring some a different cymbal rudiment, you know, into this particular thing. Or let's double the drums. Let's see if we can't, you know, double the tempo. Bring that up. Maybe it's a different feel, a different sound. But it's definitely. I don't become super precious about it, but there are a handful of things that I'll just push a little bit.
Yeah, you can't. It's not like a zero or a thousand precious.
No, it's definitely like.
You got to have some preciousness.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll get you out of here on something fun.
Oh.
Normally I would ask, you know, who would you like to collaborate with?
Oh, fun.
But I am more curious as to what you would like people to most notice about, or what you are most excited about, what's about to come for your musical journey and what you're putting out.
What a question. So as a person who wrestles with existentialism on the daily,
I don't know nothing about
that. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
anticipating something to come seems so funny to me, because we are day-to-day creatures, you know.
Facts.
And so we can project a hope or a dream, but I will say I never thought I would even have an album in this journey, and I have one, 2019, and it was amazing, and it was one of the greatest things I've ever done in my life. Never did I think I would have a second album in this journey, you know. But I've got six songs.
Second album's inevitable.
We've got about four or five more we're working on. So, and I would say that these songs, these stories, they've been marinating longer. And with any piece of meat, when you just let that thing marinate, it's going to have a better flavor. You know, it's going to taste richer. It's going to be better. And that's kind of the way I feel about these songs. They just have a different level of intensity, level of intentionality, and a level of existentialism.
Man, well, but, I'm stoked to hear it. I mean, cool. The last single was my gateway, so I'm stoked to hear it.
Dude, that's awesome. Thank you.
I can't thank you enough for coming down.
That's my joy,
I appreciate
man.
All your time and insight. And when the album drops, you got a home if you want to do a deep dive, anything you want to do.
All day, dude. Deep dive. Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, that's what we do. I'll tell you about that when we're done. Everybody watching should know. You should know.
If you don't, now you do.
Yep. Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
It's my joy, bro.
Thank you.